On 20th of October 2009, the Free University of Brussels hosted a conference on terrorism lists, executive powers, and human rights. The conference was organized by the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights and the Université Libre de Bruxelles, with the support of the Transnational Institute and of Statewatch, amongst other organizations. You are about to hear The Slow Road to Justice, the case of José María Cisson, a talk given by Jan Furman from Progress Lawyers and advocate in Cisson versus the European Union.
Describing some of the aspects of the case in which I defended José María Cisson, a Filipino national who has been listed as a terrorist in the European EU list for your understanding, not in the United Nations list. He's one of those persons, Julie Kepler spoke about this morning, only on the list of the European Union. I will try to give you some insight in what was rather aseptically described this morning by Julie Kepler, because, of course, if you hear the proceedings as he described it, that all this seems rather smooth and nice, and while we are trying to improve some of the aspects, I think the reality is, unfortunately, completely different. I will first speak, give you a few aspects on the question of the proceedings and the way it developed. I will make some comments on the improvements that were announced this morning and that were the result, that were the result of the judgment in PRMI, in the PRMI case, and show you what it practically means for my clients, what those improvements really improve or don't. And then I will also say a few words in the short time on the devastating, absolutely devastating influence this listing of my client has had on a peace process that was ongoing, because we heard a lot about use it as a lever to try to bring people to the negotiating table. Well, the problem there was there was a negotiating table. The government of the Philippines tried to break it because they didn't want to stop it. Initially, they had agreed upon, and they were fully supported by this, by the European Union, when the European Union listed the long-lasting rebellion in the Philippines as a terrorist movement. First of all, CISM was listed in 2002, in August 2002. He was first listed by the US on the 12th of August 2002. 5 days after Colin Powell visited Manila. He was then listed in a Dutch national list where he is residing in Holland since 1988. Was put on this Dutch list on the 13th of August, exactly 1 day after the US put him on the list. And then when we discovered this in a rather peculiar way, on which I will say a few words in a moment, in September 2002, and announced that we would take this to a Dutch court, because, of course, it was a Dutch list, a Dutch asset freezing list, so the Dutch court was competent. He was taken off the Dutch list put on the EU list. And so when we talked to the Dutch authorities, they said, well, it's not our problem anymore. It's now on the EU list, and we're just applying a decision of the EU. The difference is that probably in a Dutch court, when the decision to put him on the Dutch list would have been submitted to a judicial review in Holland, that would probably have taken between 3 and 6 months to get a decision. In the European Court of Justice, where we finally had to go to challenge the European list, it took, for the first decision, 5 years. For the second decision, it took 2 more years. The second decision, always the ruling was in favor of Professor Cisson, but the second decision was pronounced on the 30th of September, and we're probably not finished with this because the Council is considering appealing the decision. Let me say something about the circumstances in which José María Seisan found out that he was a terrorist, because I think that's emblematic for the way it worked. He had this card which he paid every month. At the end of every month, he paid, his bank paid, in fact, his the food he bought in the grocery store. He had a special card. So for 10 years, that had been without any problem, until at some point in September 2002, suddenly he got an angry letter from the grocery store saying, you didn't pay last month your groceries. And so he went to the bank and said, what's the problem? Why didn't you pay as you did the last 10 years? Why didn't you pay my groceries this month? And he said, well, you're on a terrorist list. Your assets are frozen. So that's the way Professor Seisan heard about the fact that he was considered as a terrorist. We then, of course, said, could we please know the reasons why he is on this listing? And the Dutch government first didn't respond. The second, once he was taken off the Dutch list and put on the European list, we asked the same question to the Council of the European Union. And then we got the answer that in several times we got first the answer that that was secret information. That was one of the strongest problems because we are considered as a terrorist and submitted to severe sanctions. Then they said, well, could we have access to the file? We actually launched a proceeding in the European Union to try to get access to the file. And then we got, the second time, we got the answer that there was no file, which was a rather surprising answer. And, of course, we challenged that in the European Court of Justice. And then they said, well, there is a file, but in fact, the file was made up by documents that were brought to the meeting by one of the member states. And the member states took the documents back. So we don't have any copy of the file left. So we said, could we please then know which member state submitted a file to this committee that listed Professor Seisan? Because then at least we can try on a national level to get access to these documents, which were at the base service listing. And then they said, no, that's unfortunately impossible because the state, the information on which state produced these documents is also secret information. So that led me to say at several occasions that, in fact, in this initial stage, at least, the European Union adopted the code of proceedings of the Spanish Inquisition, where the whole proceeding was conducted on a secret file, and where you had to try to find out what exactly was the arguments held against you. It's not only from that perspective that we are in a situation similar to the Spanish Inquisition. It's also on another point. In fact, the whole proceeding is not, we have some evidence that you have been involved in terrorist activity. The whole proceeding is based on, we're not going to show you the evidence we have, because that's secret evidence. So please show us that you're not a heretic. Show us that you're not a terrorist. And so the whole proceeding long, we have been confronted with this kind of problem, which I think, I was very happy to hear today Gilles de Kerckhoff say that this excellent judgment in the PMOI, the unfortunate part of it is that for years they have been arguing that they should not do what the court imposed upon them in the PMOI case. It's give at least a basic insight on what are the reasons to put somebody on the list. The second point is that the sanctions imposed upon the person are extremely harsh. My client was living in Holland since 1988. He was not allowed to work because there was some discussion about his resident status in Holland, and so he had a social allowance of €203 a month. These €203 a month, which is really not an amount which allows you to live as a rich person in Holland, were taken away from him. Not only the €203 were taken away from him, he was also in a situation, and that's a normal consequence of the listing, that he could not get insurance for a car or for his house at some point the question was whether he could have health insurance. Then he was living in an apartment that was rented to him by the Dutch authorities, by the local authorities. And at some point he received a letter, and that's actually how we knew that he was taken from the Dutch list to the EU list, because the EU list was the first time mentioned in this document. He was told that he had to leave the apartment. His wife and his child could stay in the apartment, but he was a terrorist and he had to go. So that means, in fact, that as far as I'm concerned, it's a proceeding, and that's what I said at several occasions, maybe in a somewhat provocative way, but I think there is also a lot of truth in it, that this listing was a proceeding done according to the procedural rules used by the Spanish Inquisition and imposed upon those who were listed, at least when it's about individuals, a sanction that was abolished by the French Revolution, and that was called civil death, which means that you were completely excluded as a person from all economic and social life, because that was, in fact, what it does. My client was made a beggar for all these years. For all these years, he had to live from the solidarity from some of his friends, because there was no other means to have any form of income and no other means for him to participate normally in economic life. So I think we have to be very much aware of what the consequences are. Now, has this anything to do with the struggle against terrorism? Well, no, because the bank account that was frozen, this morning you heard, and it's the first time I hear it this way, I think it's true what Gilles de Kerckhove said, it's an instrument of political pressure, this listing. It has not much to do with combating financing of terrorism. Nevertheless, the official reason given for installing this instrument was it was absolutely essential to stop the financing of terrorism. Well, in my client's case, the only account that was blocked was an account he had in common with his wife, in which he had the tremendous amount of saving of €2,000 and the social allowance of €203 a month. That's the only financial consequences of the decision that only practical consequences. It went up to the point when we pleaded in the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg on this point. The Greek judge asked, I think, a very logical question to the Dutch government that acted as an intervener in the proceeding and said, did you find any suspicious transactions? Is your decision based on any suspicious transactions, financial transactions in which Mr. Sisson could have been involved? And then the Dutch lawyer who represented the Dutch state panicked for a moment and said, I have no idea. Please let me consult with my people. And she had a whole battery of people with large files behind who started looking into the files. And then she came back and said, no, we didn't find any suspicious transaction after we froze the account. Which led the great judge to say, oh, yes, thank you, of course, but maybe before you froze the account, there. And so the problem is that this rather silly situation shows that the question whether my client could have been involved in financing terrorism has not even been taken into consideration in any way. That's not the problem, that's what it's all about. It's indeed a question of putting political pressure on. In order to understand this, I have to say three words about who is my client and what is his situation toward the Philippines. José María Sisson was the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines, was arrested under the Marcos regime as the founder of the Communist Party and held for 10 years in solitary confinement. During this whole period, indeed, an armed conflict exists, and it still exists today in the Philippines. An armed conflict existed between the government and the rebellion, which is structured around the Communist Party, but where there's a whole series of organizations that are working under the umbrella of an organization called the National Democratic Front. For obvious reasons, because it was a solitary confinement, my client between the end of the 60s when he was arrested and the end of the 70s 70s when he was arrested, and the 80s when he was released, when the Marcos regime collapsed, was not involved in any leading activities in the conflict because he was in solitary confinement and therefore could not have any leading role. The attempt of leadership of the rebellion was, of course, took over. In the beginning of the 90s, the National Democratic Front and the government of the Philippines decided to engage in a negotiating process, in a peace process. This peace process led to a series of, I think, important agreements, partial agreements. The first agreement was that there would be a roadmap towards solution of the conflict, and that the question of putting an end to the armed conflict and to armed confrontation would be the end result of a series of steps that had to be taken by the different parties. Some of these steps were respect for international humanitarian rights, respect for some democratic rights, land reform, some of these. So both parties agreed upon the fact that concrete steps in these questions should lead to peace. Now, some important things have been done. For example, both parties have set up, made an agreement at some time, signed an agreement that they would both respect the international humanitarian right in the conflict, and they have set up a joint monitoring mechanism for the respect of the international humanitarian right, which is still active today. There is an office held jointly by the government of the Philippines and by the National Democratic Front in Manila that is monitoring complaints about human rights violations by the armed forces of both parties. And also human rights violations by this agreement, very strangely, maybe also says that both parties should bring to justice, which implies that both parties recognize implicitly that the other one has a justice system. Both parties should bring to justice human rights violators and those who commit eventually war crimes in the conflict. So I think that was an important development. At some point, there was also a very important provision saying that both parties would work for national sovereignty in the Philippines. Now, national sovereignty in the Philippines was a very simple, not this complicated problem, but the most, visible aspect of it was that there were two large U.S. bases, military bases, under the pressure of a vast popular movement which brought, organized by the National Democratic Front, which brought hundreds of thousands of people into the street. These bases departed. These bases were removed from the Philippines. At the end of the 90s, there was a problem because the government of the Philippines could not deliver on land reform, could not deliver on democratic reforms, and the U.S. was trying to get the bases back, which were all violations of the initial agreement that had been taken. And so at that time, before 9/11, during the negotiations, the government of the Philippines said, well, either you accept our proposals in the peace negotiations that were served to the National Democratic Front, of which, in the meanwhile, my client was an advisor to the peace negotiations. They said, either you accept this at our conditions, or we will, instead of going on with this kind of negotiation, we will criminalize your movement and you personally as a terrorist. That was done before 9/11. And actually, that is what happened. My client was put, as I told you, first on the U.S. list after Colin Powell visited Manila, then immediately on the Dutch list. And when the Dutch got into trouble because we were going to challenge that in court, into the EU list. What is the result in the field? The result in the field is, of course, that these negotiations, which were, of course, a difficult process, but which have been based on the point of respect for international law, recognizing that in some armed conflicts, the use of force, that internal armed conflicts exist, and that the use of force in these conflicts is not necessarily incompatible with international law. The negotiations were based on this, and a reform of some form of mutual recognition. And actually, there were steps forward taken. When the government of the Philippines completely changed its option and went into criminalizing the opposition movement, to criminalize the rebellion, of course, course, the whole process was broken. Not only the whole process was broken, but moreover, the government of the Philippines, the authorities in the Philippines, engaged into a completely different approach because criminal, if you consider your opponent as a criminal, of course, you find him with very seriously different means than when you consider him as a party, an opponent, which might use armed force. The result in the Philippines has been that not only official repression against the rebellion has been terrible, but moreover that death squads appeared, that 800 people have been killed in the meanwhile since Professor Sisson and some parts of the opposition movement have been included in the EU list and in the American list. So what actually happened is that the EU legitimized by putting Professor Sisson and the Communist Party, amongst others, of the Philippines into the list, legitimized this evolution in the Philippines and helped the government of the Philippines to depart from the negotiating process and to engage into brutal and savage repression against the progressive movement. And so when I heard this morning that Gilles de Kerckhoff said we should use it as a lever, etc., it was used as a lever. Unfortunately, a lever that went completely into the wrong direction, a lever that was used to support an oppressive government that wanted to get away from a stance in which it took earlier and which was leading to negotiations and some advance. So I think it's important to see these consequences. The consequences on the personal level, where the person is left without any form of actual possibility to challenge the charges brought against him. And on the other hand, the effect also on what is happening in countries not where Al-Qaeda is doing some attack or something like that, but a country where a long-lasting conflict is ongoing and where both parties try to find a solution to this conflict. It had a devastating influence on this. We won twice in the European courts. Sisson has been delisted by the European Court twice, once in July 2007 on procedural grounds. That was a consequence of the decision earlier in the Mujahideen case, in which the European Court said you at least have to bring some kind of statement of reasons and submit it to contradiction. Even before the court decided to delist or to annul the inclusion of Sisson in the list that were taken between 2002 and 2006, that was the discussion during the first Sisson case, these lists. The court took more than a year to take its decision. In the meanwhile, 10 days before the court decided to annul this whole series between 2002 and 2006 of inclusions of Sisson in the list, in the meanwhile, the European Union put him again on the list 10 days before the court took its decision. And so we had to launch a second case. In this second series of listings that has been annulled now, we got a statement of reasons. We got one page saying that the Dutch State Council in 1992 and 1995 approved the decision of the Minister of Justice in Holland not to grant asylum to Sisson. Now, first of all, we said, what does this have to do with terrorism, of course? You take an asylum decision and you try to transpose it to this regime, which is absolutely in contradiction with the legal requirements you've set out yourself. Now, furthermore, and that's why I'm a little bit skeptical about the big advances that were made in notification and making people understand why they were included on the list. Furthermore, while the statement of reason says that the Dutch State Council had approved the decision of the minister, unfortunately for the European Union, the Dutch State Council had annulled the decision of the minister. So there was not even a question of is it a little bit grey or a little bit less grey? It's simply black and white, the council said. When we got the proposal, and I will end on this, I think it's important to have this insight in how practical things work. When we got the proposal for statement of reasons, because you get a letter, the letter deal that Kerkhoff spoke about this morning. You get the letter in advance, and they say, we have the intention to include you in the list on these grounds. We wrote not only to the Council, but we wrote also a letter to the 27 member states saying, this is not even a question that can be discussed. It's a blunt error. Please, we will send you the decision and the English translation of the decision so that you can see that what you put on paper is simply nonsense. It doesn't have anything to do with the truth. The answer, that's the way we were heard. Right? Then I was very happy to hear this morning that was then submitted to a very thorough discussion and a very serious examination by the committee, because, well, I was happy and at the same time a little bit surprised, because in our case, 2 months later, we got exactly the same statement of reasons with the error in it. So I think there's a problem there, because if 27 representatives of the member states looked thoroughly into this argument and examined it carefully, as it was told this morning, then I think these 27 members of the committee should be immediately sacked, because they can't read the decision of a justice. They can't basically read even the most elementary decision of a court. Now, I think, basically, I don't believe the story about the 27 people sitting in the thoroughly examining, etc. I don't believe it either, because I have some insight in how it really happened to somebody, and I will not say who, because that would probably put him in trouble. Described to me how it really happened. At some point, I had the opportunity to meet somebody who was sitting on the committee, and I said, but you knew this was crap. You knew this was rubbish. You know this was absolutely false. He said, yes, yes, yes. Yes, we knew it. I said, but why didn't you take action? Why didn't you say, we cannot do this? The statement of reasons is simply not adequate. It's in contradiction with reality. He said, oh, it doesn't work this way. Every state brings his lists, and then we stapple them together. And I said, why are you doing this? He said, well, you know, if we start discussing about a proposal of this state or another state, then they will start discussing about our proposals. So we don't get into that. That's much too complicated. We simply take the proposals of the different member states, and that's how the list is established. And so I think this person was reliable, because as far as I know, he sat at the table when it happened. Now, I think that's the reality of what happens on this level. And I wanted to share it with you, because I think it's really in a rather strong contradiction with the rather skeptical description you had this morning of how well it went. One very worrying point, if you allow me to conclude on this, is that this morning, in the last CSUN case, which was pronounced on the 30th of September, the European Court of Justice said, you can't take a decision in the asylum proceeding, and then, which moreover is 92 and 95, and then use this to list somebody in 2002. The legal requirement is a decision by a competent judicial authority, that is a decision to prosecute, to investigate, or to convict for terrorist acts. And a proceeding you take from an asylum case doesn't meet these requirements. That's the sense of the second decision positive decision we got from the European Court of Justice. I carefully listened to Gilles de Kerckhove this morning, and he said, we have a problem with this, and we will have to review this, and we will have to see, because he said something about the role of the intelligence community in the U.S., and what I strongly fear is that the result of the proceedings that we have conducted in the European Court will not be that this kind of outrageous decision will not be taken in the future, but that a common position will be changed. And that instead of a decision, and that's what Gilles de Kerckhove announced this morning, if we read between the lines, that the common position will be changed in such a way that in the future there will be no requirement for a decision by a competent judicial authority for investigation, etc., but that the fact that the Secret Service is launching an investigation will be considered to be enough to put somebody on the list. That's what he announced this morning. And I think that's an extremely worrying development, because the main question here is there is no judge, there's no intervention of a judge whatsoever in the whole process, except by this indirect way. And from what I understand from Jill Lekekov, that's what they're going to kick out now. They're going to kick out the judge. This legal requirement that at least the judge or the judicial authority should have looked into the case at the national level before the EU can list it. And I think that's a development which we really should oppose.
You have just listened to the speech delivered by Yann Fermant at the conference Terrorism Lists, Executive Powers, and Human Rights, which was held on 20th of October 2009 at the Free University of Brussels. For further information on human rights and the global state of exception, visit the Equipo Niscor website and look for the page that deals with this topic. The original recording of this talk was made during the conference by Radio Niscor. This audio document was produced on 21st of July 2010 at Radio Niscor's Belgian studios.